It is therefore ordered and adjudged that the said Donald John Trump be, and he is hereby, acquitted of the charges in said articles.
True, but that doesn't mean he didn't do it. 'Cause he did. All of it.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's one reason.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., in Red Bluff and Redding, California, on KFOI, Round Mountains, KKRN, and Eureka's KGOE. Up in Oregon, on the Central Coast, on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania, on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio, on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP. In Grand Rapids on WPRR, in New Orleans on WHIV, Gallup, New Mexico's KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, Deprogrammed Radio, and Detour Talk, blanketing planet Earth as much as we can, 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. And while today might normally be a day for special coverage of the historic impeachment Senate trial acquittal of the most lawless president by far the United States has ever known on Wednesday, or special coverage of his ugly and bitter State of the Union address on Tuesday, or special coverage of the ongoing meltdown of the first nominating contest of the 2020 election cycle in Iowa on Monday, kicking off the selection of Trump's Democratic reelection opponent, we have an unholy alliance of all three nightmares at once today. I am inclined to call it the peak Trump moment for a nation under siege from within, but I fear we may not be anywhere near the peak yet, particularly if this man is allowed to win a second term in office. Nonetheless, we will do our best to cover all three of these landmark historic moments all at once today as nightmare upon nightmare continues to pile up and batter an anxious and exhausted nation, or at least an anxious and exhausted radio show host. Yes, Donald Trump was acquitted by a corrupt and cowed Republican majority in the U.S. Senate just before airtime today on two articles of impeachment, abuse of power and corruption of Congress. Obstruction of Congress, I'm sorry. Oh, close, both. In any event, it was his attempt to cheat on the 2020 election and cover it up, for which he is clearly guilty, according to all of the evidence and every single witness allowed to testify, which, by the way, was very few, thanks to the same corrupt and cowed Republican majority blocking any and all new firsthand eyewitnesses and documents for the first time ever in a Senate impeachment trial. And even according to many of the shameless Republican senators who voted to acquit him today, he was actually guilty as charged. Nonetheless, they voted to acquit him on a slim majority vote against conviction of 52-48 on Article 1, abuse of power, with all Democrats and independents and Republican Mitt Romney all voting guilty, and all of the other Republicans voting not guilty just before air today. And on the second count, obstruction of justice, Romney voted with the Republicans in a strict partisan line vote, 53-47, to acquit this president of attempting to cover up his abuse of power by denying all witnesses and documents subpoenaed by the U.S. House for the very first time in American history. As that matter inked its way into the history books, the results of the Democratic Iowa caucuses are still unknown at this hour, thanks to the failure of an untested, secretly developed smartphone app meant to report caucus results, which are recorded at each site with hand-marked paper. That smartphone app that a few of us had warned against strongly in advance of the caucuses, as we have regarding so much similarly dangerous, non-transparent, vulnerable, unnecessary computer technology being forced upon voters in our elections for the first time in the critical 2020 election, with still 2 days later. After the Iowa caucuses, only partial results released by the Iowa Democratic Party after they had insisted on creating and using this failed app. And then there was Tuesday night's ugly, divisive State of the Union address amidst all of this. That included a snubbed handshake for the Speaker of the House by the president, a speech full of out-and-out, easily demonstrable lies, false attacks on Democrats and the former president, a series of out-and-out TV game show-like stunts, the nation's highest award given to an infamous racist misogynist right there in the chamber during the speech, a number of Democrats who walked out during the address, the father of a child killed in a school shooting being ejected from the chamber, all of which ended with the Speaker of the House tearing up her copy of the president's speech as soon as he finished. The president, by the way, who failed to mention impeachment or Ukraine or their war with Russia that he pretends to care about. He didn't mention concerns about election security. He didn't mention the Iowa caucus, which maybe was an unusually rare moment of grace for that man. And naturally, he did not mention our worsening climate crisis, as he never does, unless to scoff at it, all in what seemed to me at least to be the ugliest, meanest spirited State of the Union address in his 3 years, and I'm not an historian, but I am just guessing the ugliest in the history of the nation. Joining us, as always, of course, is the perhaps no less anxious and exhausted radio show producer, Desi Doyen, today. Hello, Desiree.
Hello.
Are we at peak Trump yet?
God, I hope so. But I think you're right that we should buckle up for worse.
I'm also delighted. Oh, I'm well buckled, believe you me. I'm also delighted. You know, there are so many corporate pundits and elected officials and academic experts out there who have been so wrong and wrong and wrong for so long about so many things that has brought us to this moment. Even while folks like my guest today have quietly been right and right and right year after year, decade after decade. So I am just delighted to be surrounded today by people who actually get it and always have, who did not need external events to force them to rethink their already correct opinions. At least mostly. I'm sure I'll have to correct both of them sometime, somehow today. The great Heather Digby Parton, you heard her laugh there. She is known far and wide as simply Digby. She's the award-winning proprietor of the long-running Hullabaloo blog and a regular contributor at Salon.com and to this program of late, not to mention our go-to thought leader in times of turbulence and despair when all seems lost. I think that's a compliment, Digby.
I'm going to take it as one. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being had. Tom Sullivan is an Asheville, North Carolina-based writer. He has written for the Asheville Citizen Times, Huffington Post, Bill Moyers and Company, and most prestigiously, if you ask me, right next to Heather at Digby's Hullabaloo each day, where he's the East Coast morning guy for us layabout West Coasters. Like Heather and me, he is also a progressive activist in the battleground state of North Carolina, author of For the Win, which is a nuts and bolts training guide in countywide get out the vote operations, which should be required reading for every goddamn so-called professional Democratic Party strategist in every county, in every state in the country this year. Tom Sullivan, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Thanks, Brad. That was over the top, and I hope I deserve it.
Yeah, all I ask is that you live up to it. All right, somehow We're going to fly through all of these things quickly today. Wish us all luck. Heather, let me start with you. And the State of the Union is what I described as the ugliest State of the Union address in the history of this nation, so we can frankly move past it as quickly as possible and on to all the other nightmares. Your quick top-line thoughts on what we all witnessed on Tuesday night.
Well, it was pretty awful. Obviously, it was in the, you know, the atmospherics of it were bizarre, to say the least. I mean, he was in the middle of the, I guess you'd call it the deliberation, such as it was, of his impeachment trial.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the first president to have that happen. We had it happen with Clinton, although Clinton was much more skilled at being able to, you know, present himself as something of a dignified, you know, leader in a situation like that.
He apologized
to the whole country. Having this and doing the State of the Union speech in the midst of an impeachment for someone like Clinton, I think that was probably a very tough moment to have to go face the public and try to, you know, be presidential and do all of that. I don't think for Trump it was. He doesn't care about any of that. If anything, he was angry. I mean, you could see that edginess in him, and it showed. The speech, of course, you know, probably a Stephen Miller special. Was pretty awful, as you say. I mean, they did this sort of Oprah-like kind of political, you know, emotional manipulation thing with having some of the people in the audience, and they were making sort of a feint toward perhaps pretending that they care about racial minorities.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not in a real serious attempt to actually get racial minority votes, but more trying to lure back some of the Republican suburban women who are appalled by his very existence and trying to, you know, make him seem like a softer personality. But of course, you know, he immediately, you know, quote, pivoted to his rally speech that was really only devoid of the usual crude invective that accompanies it, but all the ideas underlying it were exactly what he says in his rally speech, culminating in a moment that was the most grotesque display I've ever seen, I honestly, by a president. I mean, to reward Rush Limbaugh, the most odious political personality of the last 30 years. And I would, you know, even include, you know, say he was more odious than Donald Trump, even.
Donald Trump would not be here if it were not
Rush Limbaugh. Rush Limbaugh made Donald Trump possible, and he paved the way for him for 30 long years. And it was absolutely disgusting. And Trump using his sort of reality show, you know, shtick there, by it was almost as if he was doing the beauty pageant thing, you know, that he was kind of, and it was, he was sitting there going, and you know, Miss Florida, Rush Limbaugh, you know, wins the crown, and you know, Melania put the crown on and whatever, and Rush played along by playing this sort of surprised ingenue, I didn't expect such a thing. Oh, this is so surprising.
Yeah. Like, everyone in the entire United States already knew that this was going to happen.
Right.
And, of course, he knew, too. I mean, there's no doubt about that. So, you know, the whole thing was so contrived. But, truly, it was a dagger to the heart of every liberal in the United States who's followed politics. It was absolutely saying, you know, just I'm sticking it to you, and I'm going to twist that knife. You impeach me, this is what you get for it. And that's why Nancy Pelosi tore up the speech. I mean, it was like, you know, really? Really? You're going to go this far, you piece of work.
Yeah.
And, you know, so her reaction was not just, I mean, I think it was genuine. I don't think they planned it ahead of time. But it was certainly necessary. If she hadn't done something like that, I think the rest of us would have been sitting there going, jeez, you know, potted plants.
Yeah, I think that's what people are going to remember. I mean, there was so much lying in the address itself. I remember a day when we used to, I'm old enough to remember when we used to, you know, debate and discuss various policy issues that would be introduced in the State of the Union. But there was just so much stuff and nonsense that it almost seems beside the point, you know, to talk about it, to even discuss the lies. Or even to debunk them, because it was all about the theatrics. And that, I think, is the only thing that people will remember. Now, we should note, by the way, it wasn't only Pelosi tearing up that speech at the end. Donald Trump actually snubbed her handshake at the beginning. And yet, Tom Sullivan, Sean Hannity called the ripping up moment, quote, one of the most classless things I've ever seen in the history of the State of the Union.
Yes, of course.
Jason Chaffetz, I've never seen anybody act so childish in my life. Even the vice president was on Fox and Friends, said I wasn't sure if she was ripping up the speech or the Constitution. Well, he can be sure the Constitution was the one that was already ripped up before the speech started by Trump. Tom, I suspect that's going to be the only thing that anyone ends up remembering from this speech. Does any of this actually matter to voters in 2020?
Man, I don't know. There was such a flurry of lies there. He threw so much into the air that it was hard to even keep up with it. It reminded me of something that Billy Bush had told Bill Maher a while back, that Trump's approach to this sort of thing is, he told him on the Bill Maher show, you mm-hmm. just tell them lies and they believe it. You just tell it to them and they believe it. Whatever the lie is or whatever the truth is, you just lie bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're starting to become numb to it, you know, except Stephen Miller gets a thrill out of it, but it's really tough to take, and it's psychologically just wearing. I think he's either trying to wear us out or outlast us.
And he's doing a good job of it too. There was a litany of his own accomplishments in the past 3 years, and obviously it's only an hour long program, so we don't have the 10 or 20 hours we'd need to debunk all of these. But he said, if we hadn't reversed the failed economic policies of the previous administration, the world would not now be witnessing this great economic success. He boasted in just one of dozens and dozens of easily debunkable lies. For example, Trump claimed record job growth during his first 3 years in office, but David Axelrod, Obama's former advisor, was quick to tweet in rebuttal that the last 3 years of the Barack Obama administration produced more jobs than the first 3 years of Donald Trump's administration. He also notes unemployment fell from 10.2 to 4.7. That's more than 5 points under Obama. It's fallen another 1.2% under Trump. But it was just that sort of thing. And, you know, as long as they're going to be focusing on the economy, I guess we do have to sort of respond to some of these points to, you know, to show that, no, this was pretty much all on autopilot, Mr. President. If anything, you've made it worse. But, Tom, is there any particular lie that got under your craw since you brought it up from Tuesday's State of the Union?
Oh, the going after the government schools,
yes,
really annoyed me in a big way. Someone else had pointed this out, but I mean, support for public schools in this country predates the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
This is as an American as you can get, but they are so determined to turn any kind of social program into a profit-making venture that they've been relentlessly attacking the public schools because teachers and school funding stands between the would-be profiteers and their money.
Yeah. And so that was his call for passing a federal bill for school choice, which, Heather, well, what's wrong with that? Here it's very popular, according to Donald Trump.
Okay. Well, you know, since public schools are actually a state and local issue, so I don't really think that's going to have much effect, even if he does it. He thinks it's interesting. You got to sort of analyze what he was after there. I mean, aside from them always wanting to create some sort of, you know, phony accomplishment to appease his right-wing base, in this case, particularly the evangelicals who really, you know, seem to be the most loyal plank in his base.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, they of course are, you know, they are into homeschooling, and they, mm-hmm. they would like to have some affirmation of that on a federal level.
And some government funding for it, too.
And some government funding. And also, he's trying to make a play, and it's important to sort of recognize this, he's trying to make a play for, as I pointed out earlier, you know, a certain, just if he could slice off a little bit of the African-American vote, he's talking about criminal justice. You know, his Super Bowl ad was about the you know, the freeing of the prisoner that Kim Kardashian had had brought to his attention, and criminal justice reform, the school choice thing, which is popular among certain groups of African Americans in urban urban centers. You know, this he's sort of trying to make this play. Now, I don't think anybody believes it. I mean, this is the guy who said, you know, some Nazis are very fine people, and, you know, he did the Central Park Five thing and called, you know, said S-hole nations, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think he's fooling anyone. And I do think that that's mostly as a way to try and lure back some of those Republican women. But, you know, this you know, his evocation of government schools, I think all of that is leading to a full-blown assault on socialism. That, you know, government schools has that ring to it, right? I mean, doesn't it sound a little Stalinist or whatever?
Well, you know what? And that perfectly sets up where I was going. And I'm glad to hear. Well, we'll see if you're right, whether that, you know, Queen for a Day stunt that where he, you know, gave away that scholarship or whatever it was. We'll see if that fools anybody. But since you brought up socialism, before we move on, you'll note I haven't been playing, you know, any of these clips from this guy, which is, you know, so much like fingernails on a chalkboard, I think, to many, including me today. But I do want to play one because I think this will be important moving forward in the 2020 election cycle. Well, let me just play this and then we'll talk about it.
But as we work to improve Americans' health care, there are those who want to take away your health care, take away your doctor, and abolish private insurance entirely. 132 lawmakers in this room have endorsed legislation to impose a socialist takeover of our health care system, wiping out the private health insurance plans of 180 million very happy Americans. To those watching at home tonight, I want you to know, we will never let socialism destroy American health care.
So, since Heather brought up socialism, you know, Bernie Sanders, who I rather like in many regards, has had it pretty easy so far. Unlike, say, Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden or even Elizabeth Warren, you know, in regards to the attacks from the right, who are now, you know, pretending to be concerned that Democrats, the Democratic establishment, is attempting to steal the nomination from Bernie. They've been up in arms about that over on Fox News, as they also claimed happened in 2016. You know, if he is the nominee, he will face unprecedented attacks, just like that template that was just laid out by Donald Trump there during his State of the Union address. Tom Sullivan, what will be the effect of such an attack if Bernie does end up as the nominee?
Well, I mean, the whole approach to this is death by a thousand cuts. The first one doesn't get you, but the 10th and the 11th one will. And as, again, it's relentless repetition. And triggering the people's lizard brains back there, and they've got their language and they've got their message discipline that the Democrats can't seem to muster, and you know, it's just like butter emails. They'll they'll work it until they try to undermine it as much as they can. Sanders is going to have to face that, and he's going to have to deal with that, and especially around health care. And you know, I've been joking about the people who want a piecemeal health care, that if you like your deductibles and your copays, you can keep them.
but apparently not, because his plan and Elizabeth Warren's plan eventually would take away those copays and deductibles by taking away private insurance. And to a lot of people, that sounds really scary. Now, you know, when you say taking away private insurance, they're replacing it with insurance for everybody all the time. No insurance necessary.
That is cheaper.
That it would be cheaper for them. Right. But when you say they're 180 million or whatever are going to lose their, was going to wipe out their health care because of socialism,
I think that freaks people out, but I don't know what to make of that yet. Heather, I'm worried that many supporters of Bernie's are quite susceptible to this purposeful manipulation along the lines of today, for example, Fox News was on about how the DNC is pulling out the stops to defeat Bernie. Between that and the attack you heard in the speech last night and Trump's attack on Sanders as a communist, as he did before the Super Bowl on Sunday, should that be a concern for Democratic primary voters?
Well, I think it is. I think whether it should be or not, I don't know, but I suspect that a lot of people are worried about it. Look, you know, socialism, and I, you know, it's like what we're talking, what Bernie really is, what we know he is. Mm-hmm. You know, he's kind of an FDR New Deal type mm-hmm. liberal, really.
Yeah.
By certainly on international standards, he doesn't fit into anything that they would define as socialism. But he does like to call himself a socialist, a democratic socialist, but nonetheless, he does take the label. I might have thought it would be wiser to call himself a social democrat,
mm-hmm.
But that ship sailed. So that's just going to be a factor in the election. And I think I do believe that it is going, you know, it's a hurdle. Let's just put it that way. They all have hurdles, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, whoever the candidate is going to have hurdles, and I think that is the one that is probably going to be most difficult for mm-hmm. the Democrats if Bernie wins. On the other hand, you know, we have a president who is so incoherent that he said last night, and this was something written in his speech. I mean, he doesn't even know what he was just, you know, babbling it. He didn't know what he was saying. But,
right.
You know, the fact that he said it in the State of the Union, he said, socialism destroys a nation and freedom unifies the soul. What the heck does that mean? I mean, what is he talking about? So, in a way, that makes me a little bit less worried that it will have the effect that we think, because he's an idiot. he's not, you know, I don't think he's as capable as someone else would be. I mean, I think there are candidates who could make a case against socialism that would resonate, because there's something, it's kind of in a lot of Americans' DNA to be, even today, even with the kids who all, you know, like socialism or you know, say they do, there's still something in American DNA that kind of recoils a little bit around the word socialism. I mean, there's a reason why mm-hmm. we have the weak welfare state that we have. There is a reason for it. This is America, you know, and I'm not saying it's good. I'm not even defending it. I'm just observing it. And so, you know, there is an issue there.
But among the most beloved programs in the country, you know, are Social Security, Medicare, of course, the military, of course, the public schools, all socialistic programs.
How about the VA?
And the
VA
is
the most socialist program we have.
Exactly. I mean, but I think we also have to talk about the role of the corporate media in all of this, because, of course, Republicans and the Trump campaign are going to label the Democratic nominee as a socialist no matter who it is.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to lie about what democratic socialism is versus, you know, authoritarian socialism like in Venezuela. So the corporate media is going to help them do that no matter what, because, you know, Democrats are really bad at defining these narratives for the public, but the corporate media makes sure that it actually gets repeated as often as possible. These lies get repeated.
Desi Doyen, you have such low expectations for the corporate media. I don't know what happened to you. Let me take a quick break, and we will come back with Heather Digby-Parton and Tom Sullivan and Desi Doyen and myself right here on the broadcast as special coverage of pretty much everything at once, from the State of the Union to impeachment to the Iowa meltdown. All continues with impeachment, I believe, up next. I'm Brad Friedman. This is the broadcast. Don't touch that dial.
I swore an oath before God to exercise impartial justice. The president is guilty of an appalling abuse of public trust. Corrupting an election to keep oneself in office is perhaps the most abusive and destructive violation of one's oath of office that I can imagine. Were I to ignore the evidence that has been presented and disregard what I believe my oath and the Constitution demands of me for the sake of a partisan end, it would, I fear, expose my character to history's rebuke and the censure of my own conscience.
Amen. Amen.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Our special coverage of the State of the Union and the impeachment trial vote of the President of the United States and the Iowa caucus debacle continues with my guests Heather Digby Parton, Tom Sullivan, both of the trusted decades-long accurate Digby's Hullabaloo blog as we move from the State of the Union to impeachment now. That was Utah's Republican senator and former Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney announcing in an emotional speech, holding back tears, as he discussed his commitment to God to honor his oath of impartial justice in the impeachment of Donald John Trump and his intention to vote for the conviction and removal of the President of the United States during Senate arguments on Wednesday before the vote on acquittal or conviction for Trump on two articles of impeachment for abuse of power and obstruction of justice. That final vote held just before airtime today was 52-48 on the first article on abuse of power, 53-47 to acquit on the second article, obstruction of Congress. Of course, as expected, neither vote came anywhere close to the required two-thirds vote needed to remove a president, which has never happened in American history, but nobody seriously thought it would with these particular Republicans in this particular Senate, especially after they voted to join the obstruction themselves by blocking all new witnesses and documents in the trial for the first time in any Senate impeachment trial in U.S. history. But while I realize the bar is pretty low these days, Heather, I was going to ask, after I heard Mitt Romney's speech earlier today, whether he deserves a Profiles in Courage Award for his willingness to vote to convict on the obvious guilt of this president, at least on the first article of impeachment, abuse of power. But then he voted not guilty on the second one. So, Heather Digby Parton, does Mitt Romney deserve a Profiles in Courage Award there for that?
Well, I don't know. You know, one of the first Profiles in Courage Awards that they did, you know, this is the Kennedy Center or mm-hmm. whatever, and it was in the book, in JFK's book, was about the senator who voted to acquit Andrew Johnson. He was the deciding vote. And, of course, you know, he was, you know, a racist Confederate mm-hmm. that ended up, you know, acquitting Andrew Johnson, let's just put it this way, wasn't a good thing. But he got the Profile in Courage Award from the, you know, in the book. So I'm not sure those really mean much in these situations. Having said that, I do, you know, I've got to respect Romney for doing this because it's not just him. It's not just one lone Republican who came out and, you know, followed his conscience. This is the guy that was the presidential nominee mm-hmm. 7 years ago for the Republican Party. He is a major figure. He's in the history books. He's not just some guy, you know, he's not just some backbencher. He was once the leader of the party, and he ran more than once. I mean, he was definitely considered presidential material by this party for a long, long time, for many people. He was a governor of a state. He's a senator now. I mean, he's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that he did that, I mean, what he symbolizes, what this symbolizes is the death of the Republican Party that existed before. Now, granted, I want to, you know, absolutely say up front, he is partially responsible for where things mm-hmm. ended up. Anybody in the party at his level is. They sat there and they let people like Rush Limbaugh and the rest of them create this, you know, this horror show that's become the Republican Party. But having said that, when push came to shove, at the end of the day, he did stand up against, and he said, you know, I know what I'm facing. I know what's going to happen to me. And, of course, Donald Trump Jr. immediately started tweeting that he needs to be expelled from the from the Republican Party. That's the Republican Party of today.
Yeah.
And he said, do you think I would ask for that, or do you think I would do that if my conscience didn't demand it? I mean, and this was a rebuke to everyone in the party, every one of those people who knew very well,
yeah.
know very well that what Trump did was impeachable. And it's also a big rebuke to people like Susan Collins, to people like Cory Gardner,
mm-hmm.
Martha McSally, Joni Ernst, Tom Tillis, all these Republicans in vulnerable races next fall. And their challengers can look at them and say, yeah, okay, look over here at this guy. This guy had enough integrity to do it, and you didn't.
Yep.
You didn't have what it took. You know, you have no... You know, you have no conscience, and I think that could be a powerful thing. You know, I don't think that those people are going to get off, and I think Romney helped do that. And I mean, that takes some guts; it really does.
I was happily surprised to see that yes, even the very conservative Democrats, Kirsten Sinema of Arizona,
yes.
Joe Manchin of West Virginia, Doug mm-hmm. Jones of Alabama, who you know. He perhaps most courageously, because he will be on the ballot
yep.
this year in what is, you know, seen as deep red Alabama. I wonder, Tom, you come from North Carolina, perhaps the most closely divided of all the battleground states. I wonder what
right.
you think about how A, Tillis voted, and if Doug Jones down there in Alabama, if he deserves a Profile in Courage Award for voting on both counts, unlike Mitt Romney, on both counts to convict the president.
Jones might, indeed. That's going to be a tough race. It's looking like he's going to be facing Jeff Sessions in the fall. There are other candidates in the primary, but Sessions is trending ahead, at least according to his own internal polls, so we'll find out about that soon enough.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he's gonna, he narrowly squeaked that out last time. Now he's gotta face the voters again after this race. So that's gonna be a tough race for him. Now Tillis is already weak, and I think what's going to happen to him is going to depend a lot on the candidate that the Democrats field here.
Mm-hmm.
And as often happens, the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee has already taken sides way ahead of the primary and is mm-hmm. backing a guy they backed 10 years ago who lost in the primary mm-hmm. then. So we're not looking to have somebody really strong to go up against him.
Does we had Erica Smith on this show. She is running in that primary on the Democratic side. And we had her on the show because she came out full bore in favor of hand-marked paper ballots across North Carolina. Does she have, even though Cal Cunningham, that's who it is, Cal Cunningham, is that the guy's name?
Right.
He has been the Democratic Senate committee, whatever it is all on board for that guy. Does Erica Smith have any chance of taking him down, given that support from the establishment Democrats of Cunningham?
It'll depend on the turnout. The polling on that is rather thin. She seems to have some support. She's not able to raise a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And as we know, the last time this happened, when the DSCC took sides with Cunningham against our Secretary of State, Elaine Marshall, as soon as she beat him, they took their wallet and went home. The DSCC is rather fond of male-compliant candidates mm. who are going to be able to raise money, and independent women who are strong and perhaps older, they're not so much into that.
Do we have any sense of the price that Tom Tillis may either pay for his vote today to acquit on both counts, or will that actually help him in a state like North Carolina? Or is it just too closely divided in your state for anyone to know?
It's a little too early to tell. I mean, it just happened, you know, within an hour or so. So we'll have to see how that shakes out.
In the end, and you're welcome to retract and revise your opinions down the road, of course, as we learn more about its effect on the electorate. But, Heather, was it wise to bring these impeachment charges for which he has been acquitted? And I see now he is tweeting our country's victory on the impeachment hoax. Was it wise to bring these impeachment charges? And if so, should it have been earlier and many, many more of them at the same time?
Oh, boy. Well, we've talked about this a lot as this whole thing unfolded, and I think that we were in agreement that we would have preferred to have a wider impeachment process with more charges brought. I never understood why they didn't take the Mueller obstruction of justice charges and just dump them in the lap of the Senate and say, here, read this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that word just said, you know, they didn't have to do anything. Everybody was under oath. It was all there, and just go, you know, check this out. And so, you know, they had their reasons, and we all know what they are. I mean, we heard it. They felt like they had a very open and shut case. I don't think they ever thought that they were going to actually convict Trump.
Well, that's the thing.
I mean, that was obvious.
And, well, had they brought those charges, those would have ended up the same way, presumably,
right? So it was always, you know, what can we do to make this, you know, to make this as politically effective for us as possible? Mm-hmm. And I think that what they wanted to do, honestly, was to bring, a tight case. And then it was all about the Senate. I don't think anybody had any real hopes that they were going to budge the hardcore Trump voters from him. Mm-hmm. But it was about the Senate. It's about Cory Gardner. It's about McSally. It's about, you know, Ernst. It's about those people who are in those vulnerable seats. Because I think everybody knows, Nancy Pelosi knows it, all the presidential candidates know it. If they don't get the Senate in November, having the presidency, while, of course, a massive improvement, and there are many things that a president can do on their own, it's a very powerful position, but many of the major reforms that have to be done cannot be accomplished with Mitch McConnell in charge of the Senate. So I think, you know, they knew that this was a chance to budge that, you know, the hold that Mitch McConnell and Trump had over those Senate races, and I think that was always the hope. So looking back on it, yes, I would have preferred to see I think that the corruption charges, I don't think those have had a proper airing for the public, and mm-hmm. I think the public could have seen it. But, you know, the way this unfolded with them refusing to hear from John Bolton, with them refusing to you know, get new documents, which were flooding out anyway through other places and doing all that, I mean, I can't say that it was a bad plan, and you know, I think that at the end of the day, they had no choice. I mean, they had to do something. So, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it was their absolute duty under the Constitution that they had to do something regardless of whatever the political fallout was going to be, and perhaps there will be some utility to having exposed all of these Republican senators who are now embarrassing themselves with these bizarre excuses that they're coming up with. And I wonder if you guys have any thought about how Romney talked about his oath before God, and you have all of these other public Christians in the Senate who are pretending like that oath, that was okay, it wasn't really that. Do you think that will have any impact on suburban women or evangelical voters who actually are true Christians?
Tom?
I don't know if they actually vote that way.
Okay.
There's a lot of posturing that goes on there. You know, Romney obviously, as he said, didn't want to have to explain supporting Trump to his grandkids and future generations.
Mm-hmm.
I just wish more of the Republicans would take that same approach to climate change.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
No kidding.
Yeah, well, there's going to be a lot of explaining to do. And of course, a lot of this is going to depend on what happens this November. So let's move on to what I have described as America's last firewall against full-on authoritarianism in this country. That would be, of course, the 2020 presidential election and the senatorial election, and the latest meltdown on the Democratic side of the aisle in the wake of the disastrous Iowa caucuses earlier this week. Heather and Tom and Desi will stick around for one more segment as we do all of our special coverage all at once. At least until tomorrow's special coverage of whatever currently unknown nightmares are still to come between now and then. And now I wish I hadn't said that. All right, we'll take a quick break and we'll be back with all of that. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. Don't go away.
So take a deep breath, pick yourself up, start all over again.
Yes. Yes, please. That, of course, refers to where we all are and what we all hope to do as of November, start all over again. It also, sadly, refers to the, what they're having to do right now, I guess, in the great state of Iowa. Welcome back to the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Yesterday, I had, as listeners may have heard, quite a bit to say about the disastrous use of new, untested, secretly developed technology with a smartphone app used in a mission-critical election to report otherwise fully publicly overseen results which included hand-marked paper records of local results from the caucus sites in Iowa on Monday. Of course, listeners may have also heard previous shows where I warned about the use of that very app for these caucuses, along with the other largely ignored warnings about similarly untested tech for upcoming mission-critical elections in battleground states this year, like Georgia, Pennsylvania, including Philadelphia, North Carolina, Texas, and yes, even right here in my own home county of Los Angeles, the largest in the nation. Well, 2 days later, after the Iowa caucuses, we still do not know the full results of the first-in-the-nation caucuses in the Hawkeye State. AP continues to describe it too close to call at this hour, but we have some additional numbers, which purportedly include 75% of the caucus sites at this point. They show similar results to those that we saw on Tuesday when the Iowa Democratic Party released what they saw, what they described as 62% of the precincts. Basically, Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders tied for first place by and large, with Buttigieg up just a bit, followed by Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden, and then Amy Klobuchar coming in thereafter. We are joined for our last few minutes of special coverage by my special guest today, Tom Sullivan of North Carolina, Heather Digby Parton of Yes, California, both from the blog of renown known as Digby's Hullabaloo. Heather, I'm loath to make too much of anything of these unchecked partial numbers, other than they appear to show Sanders and Buttigieg in front and Warren and Biden right behind. What's your takeaway from either, I'll give you your choice, either those partial Iowa results or the stupid, completely predictable tech meltdown that got us here?
Well, I'll let you guys talk about the tech meltdown. You're the experts on that, and I'd be interested to hear what you have to say specifically, Brad.
Oh, you should have heard yesterday's show. It was fantastic.
I missed it. Yeah, and maybe a little recap for us today. Right. Obviously, you know, it's appalling. And the vote count itself, to the extent we know it at this moment, 75% of the vote in. I mean, you know, those of us who live in California, mm-hmm. we're waiting for months for final vote count.
Yeah.
So this doesn't really seem like that big of a deal to mm-hmm. me, but I recognize the way that the primaries are set up, that people sort of slingshot out of Iowa onto New Hampshire or not, and, you know, it's a big deal to know, you know, who won. It seems clear that it was very, very close at the top. The two top is Buttigieg and Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
I think the story coming out of it, if it, you know, just to take the sort of put my pundit hat on here, is that Biden was very weak,
mm-hmm.
and I think weaker than we thought he was going to be, or that most people thought he was going to be, and knowing that, you know, he had the big name recognition, and yet, you know, polling and various reports coming out of there were that he wasn't getting crowds and that he wasn't really well organized and et cetera, et cetera. So I think that that's probably the big story, and it keeps reminding me of 2016. I mean, we talked a lot about this at the time.
Mm-hmm.
The, you know, that field had, you know, the early guys who were, you know, the early bets in 2016 and in 2020 were a couple of young guys who were going to really take over the party, wasn't? And it was Scott Walker and Beto O'Rourke,
right?
And they were the big, you know, the new, the saviors, the mm-hmm. charismatic leaders of the future, who both, you know, flamed out really
right
early.
Off the bat. Yeah,
right off the bat.
Yeah.
So it left this big field, and, you know, you had sort of the establishment guy, who I think in 2016 was Jeb Bush. Everybody thought he was really well funded. He was the guy, right? Everybody, well, okay, we didn't get our great white bread hope, Scott Walker, but mm-hmm. you know, we've got Jeb sitting here. He's gonna take it. And he flamed out, and I think the same thing is happening to Biden. So mm-hmm. we're ending up in a situation where I think we can sort of look at this race and realize that it's the same. And it's not exactly the same dynamic, but it's similar, which is a shakeup in the party itself. And you're seeing this sort of play out. And here we have the specter of a billionaire kind of hovering off over this whole race by mm-hmm. the name of Michael Bloomberg. And, you know, he's not in it the way Trump was in it in 2016, but, you know, he could easily end up being a factor if Biden flames out. So I'm kind of intrigued by that whole kind of parallel sort of, you know, comparison there.
Yeah, you're right. I think you've nailed it, and it's in that if these numbers hold up, and again, these are only 75% of the totals, but if these numbers hold up, it's almost more about who lost here, which seems to be Joe Biden versus Buttigieg, Sanders, Warren, and Klobuchar, all still clearly in there, but the disappointment of Joe Biden to his supporters. By the way, Heather, since you mentioned the voting machines and since you're out here in L.A., I don't know if you saw, but on the TV machine last night on CBS, I was in there in an investigative report there talking about the voting machines that are coming to Los Angeles this year, the 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting systems.
Oh, great.
We don't have time to play that today. I'll try to get to that on tomorrow's thrilling broadcast. But I thought you might have seen it right before Colbert last night. If not, it'll be on tomorrow's broadcast. Tom, speaking of which, you're in the, as I said, the battleground state of North Carolina, where some counties in the state, including the most populous and most diverse, I believe, Mecklenburg County.
Charlotte, yep.
Is preparing to use new, untested, secretly developed, wildly vulnerable and unsecured 100% verifiable touchscreen voting systems out there as well for the first time this year. Has there been any second guessing of that poor decision in the Tar Heel state after the disaster that is still unfolding in Iowa today, after the Iowa Democratic Party similarly chose to use new, untested, secretly developed election tech in their mission-critical caucuses?
We're still puzzling over why the County Board of Elections, you know, went with that in Mecklenburg. They seem to have been maybe tied to the hip to the vendor. I don't know. But the irony is, like, just Monday morning, I was in a meeting where we were talking about tech we were going to be using for our elections here within the party, and quickly deciding that the more complexity you have, the more chance you have of things going wrong, and then Iowa happened. You know, trying to introduce tech like that at the last minute is bad for a couple of reasons. One, it's a poor assumption that, you know, the tech that's second nature to young city dwellers is going to be easy to use for more senior, more rural activists in a host of counties across the country who can't even put up and maintain a free Facebook page.
Right.
And you're handing them this cell phone app where it's going to require them to download it, install it, go through several layers of security in order to simply get in there and enter data. It's just nuts.
Do you take anything, and I'm glad that, at least I hope, that it's freaking out people in North Carolina and that Mecklenburg comes to their senses, given how closely divided North Carolina is, to use 100% unverifiable touchscreens, even if they were reliable ones, instead of, you know, crappy ESNS touchscreens that fail all the time. I'm glad to hear that maybe this is scaring the hell out of a few people in that state, but we'll see.
You mean so, like, maybe Iowa might have done us all a favor?
Yeah, I think the Iowa,
by their abject failure.
Not just that, the Iowa Democratic Party, who everyone hates this week. Maybe we ought to thank them.
We'll see.
We'll find out. We'll see. But
they seem to have gone with this under pressure from the DNC and the media to get instant results. But there's something to be said for lower tech. It's not as fast, but it's got its advantages, and it's easier to use for a lot of people.
Well, it's not about speed. They had it out quickly enough. I mean, one of the things that the DNC was pressuring the state party to do was put out more numbers, the first round of voting, the realignment vote that takes place in these crazy caucuses that nobody knows how they work. So they wanted more data. I don't know that they wanted them to use this app. I think it was the Iowa Democratic Party that wanted to do it, despite cybersecurity experts telling them, please do not do so. Very quickly here, Tom, before I get out, on a political level, do you take anything? Should we take anything from what we saw in Iowa? Or should we all take a deep breath and just see what the hell the rest of the voters think across the country before freaking out one way or another?
I think people's romance with the latest tech gadgets is a little
sour.
Misplaced. you know, I did a digital tech review for the state on a webinar a few weeks back, and we got to talking about texting applications, and they're simply multiplying like rabbits. You can't train anybody
but,
on them.
But on a political level is what I was looking for. Should we take anything from what, you know, from Buttigieg and Sanders at the top and so on and so forth? Or is this just, you know, the first fight and more to come?
Well, I think it's bad for Joe Biden. He told a rally in New Hampshire today. He said, "I'm not going to sugarcoat it. We took a gut punch in Iowa," and you know his support seems to have been largely vaporware. And you know if he's able to recover, we'll find out in a week. Sanders and Warren are heading into New Hampshire in their backyards. They're going to have a little bit of advantage there. Buttigieg is out of his element some, so he'll have some advantages of having tied Bernie in Iowa, but we'll have to see if that stands up.
I have one quick thing. I know that it's only one primary so far, but Iowa turnout, it looks like, so far was on pace only with 2016 and I think was lower than in 2018, the turnout, and I think that is a concerning indicator for Democrats maybe on whether or not the push to get Trump out of office will actually turn out voters. That, I think, is very concerning.
Oh, absolutely. I've been saying for months, I said, you know, don't make your vote based on who you think your neighbor's going to vote for. Who would you go out in the heat of August and knock doors for?
Thus, check out Tom Sullivan's For the Win Nuts and Bolts Training Guide if you're working in your particular county to help get out the vote this year. Tom Sullivan, where can folks find that, by the way, to download?
ForTheWin.us.
ForTheWin.us. Very good. You can also find Tom Sullivan, I think, every day posing as Bloggers Are Us. That's his Twitter handle. And he uses it also when he writes over at DigbysBlog.net, which is Digby's hullabaloo, created by the great Heather Digby Parton. You can find her on the Twitters at Digby56, also over at Salon.com, and, of course, at Digby's Blog.net. Hey, really appreciate both of you joining us today on this hellish day of special coverage of everything. I look forward, sort of, to doing it again in the near future with both of you guys.
Under better circumstances, I hope.
There'll be something coming. Am I right? Don't answer that. My thanks to you both. We got to get out. My thanks to our producer as well, Desi Doyen, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am simply The Brad Blog. We will see you there. My thanks also to those of you who help keep us going over your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. Thank you. That's it. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.